Welcome back, everyone, to The Movie Palace, a new podcast taking a look at the films of old Hollywood. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and today I'm delighted, truly delighted, to be joined by blogger and freelance film critic and Spurs fan, but I'm not going to hold that against her. Her name is Kelechi Ihenuolu. Hi, Kelechi.
Hi, Carl. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. And you know what? I definitely won't hold the Spurs thing against you because we're recording this, aren't we, a few hours before England's World Cup match against Sweden.
Yeah.
Just to kind of date the recording. Yeah. And so far, it's been the Spurs players keeping the team kind of going, hasn't it?
Absolutely. How dare you even try to, like, yeah. try to criticise them? You know, I could stop this podcast right now if you want. No, it's been actually been amazing just seeing the country united over England. And I'm especially happy because Spurs seem to be doing really well as well. So fingers crossed, you know, let's see how we get on with this game today, this afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see how it goes. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, by the time this is released, like, the World Cup will be like ancient history.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're not here to talk about the beautiful game, are we? We're here to talk about the film Duck Soup from 1933. But before we do, I mean, let me just explain. I guess the way you and I know each other, Kelechi, is we've podcasted a couple of times. I think it's only a couple of times, actually, over on the Xcast, haven't we? And chatted a bit back and forth on Twitter and stuff and so on, yeah.
Yeah, so it's been sort of a bit of a crazy journey, like, between you and I in terms of, you know, we've found a newfound appreciation of the X-Files. You know, it's great to meet other fans of the show and be able to sort of debate it and look at it in a different way, in a style that reminds me of how I used to watch the show. So it was great to meet you and meet Tony and everybody else from that whole group, and just been excited to be part of that podcast as well. So you know, as always, it was always a pleasure to do those podcasts.
Yeah, and it's good to have you on this one early on as well. So just tell us then, I mean, I know the answer to this, but tell us a bit about your blog, what it's called, what kind of thing you get up to, and that sort of thing.
Okay, so as you know, I'm a creator and the writer of Confessions from a Geek Mind. And the best way to describe it is a film and TV blog that's focused on the analytical side of it. So it's an analytical film and TV blog. And it's been going on for about 5 years as a personal label of love, and I was encouraged by friends to start it up because they always thought I had interesting viewpoints about film and TV. So if you're looking for something a bit different, say from the kind of mainstream reviews that you see maybe, you know, everywhere else, my reviews tend to be kind of like a deep dive, in-depth, thoughtful essay style reviews, you know. So it's not just noting the good and the bad, but also kind of looking at the themes, you know, and the thematic resonance behind it. So, you know, looking at whether, you know, what the filmmaker or the director and the influences, you know, whether it's a particular style, is there a commentary that is trying to evoke, whether it's a social, political, so it's kind of almost like a niche idea that also has plenty of potential for expansion. So it's one of those things that is I've always been dreaming, you know, always had in me as, you know, looking at sort of beyond what a film or a TV show has done. And I love and enjoying the kind of connect the dots significances out of each presentation that I see. So it's, if you're looking for something a little bit different or you want to be informed, happy come aboard to the blog.
Yeah, definitely, and we'll make sure we give the link and everything before we wrap up and stuff. I mean, it's mainly like the newer, like, contemporary scene you're interested in, I guess, isn't it? But I mean, you're into old films as well, aren't you? I mean, I know when I suggested this to you, you kind of immediately suggested doing some slapstick comedies.
Yeah, because I feel like sometimes the slapstick comedy doesn't get the attention that that it gets, you know, it's very
it deserves,
easy. Yeah, and it deserves as well. So, you know, I know it's easy to do something like Casablanca. I know it's easy to do something like Double Indemnity, but the slapstick comedies basically comes from, I guess, it comes related to my childhood. Actually, you know, I think I've always been drawn to comedy. You know, I grew up in a household with three brothers, and in a modern sense, I was exposed to the likes of Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Jackie Chan, and Police Academy movies. So it was the exact same for like old Hollywood movies. So we used to watch together Some Like It Hot. We used to watch Sherlock Holmes with Basil Rathbone. Now, I know that you're probably thinking, well, Sherlock Holmes, that's not really funny. Well, Nigel Bruce as Watson was funny. But the biggest influence for me as on my childhood was Lauren Hardy. And watching films like The Music Box, Sons of the Desert, Saps at Sea, Way at West. And that's the kind of the visual slapstick humor that was became my kind of my upbringing. And the nostalgia just watching it with my brothers and just laughing our head off. And that probably, you know, in hindsight, probably explains where I get my sense of humor from.
Let's talk a bit about the Marx Brothers then before we get on to... Well, let's talk about them generally before we come on to Duck Soup specifically.
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean, I've always liked them. When I got into films, I found their films, you know, quite soon after and always enjoyed them. Interesting guys, you know, they have this long history, like, in vaudeville and on stage. And it sounds like they had a very, like, determined mother. But you know what? I think we might be able to get more into this in a future recording, because it might be good to devote an episode to like their background and everything, because they're a great team and everything.
Yeah.
It's almost a shame, I think, that we can't see what they were like in those earlier days on stage, because they had this long career before they even break into movies, really. Mm. You know, I think what it means is like by the time they start making films, they're very like experienced and they know what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about the vaudeville days. I mean, a lot of their jokes and humours eventually made it into the film to a wider audience. So I think it's just becomes almost like a typical practice with actors and performers of that era, where they will go on stage, they will perform a joke. If it works with the crowd, then it makes it into a later film or, you know, a later performance. If it doesn't work, then it gets cut out. So I think, as you said, that for them, that was almost like the best practice to get them in ready for that filmmaking world.
Yeah, and you know what? There's a good story about that, which is like when they make their early movies with Paramount.
Yeah.
And this is the last one they make for Paramount. But when they were filming The Coconuts, for example, they're working on the film by day.
Mm.
And then at night, they're kind of going on stage to perform Animal Crackers.
Yeah.
Like a really hectic schedule. But, you know, there's these stories that, you know, bits from the film script end up on stage, and you know they're constantly changing their stage act and everything. Sounds yeah. really fun.
Yeah, I mean, even I think when they were making Duck Soup, or just prior to making Duck Soup, because I think they were following on from the success of Horse Feathers.
Yeah,
and in between when like Paramount's like, "Yep, we want you to go and make another one. We'll rush it out and get it out in as soon as possible." They were actually doing their own radio station. I think it was Chico and Groucho doing their own radio station, so they were able to expand again their vaudeville and performances to another set of wider audience.
Yeah, so in terms of their film career, so like I said, the last one for Paramount, this. Mm. And I think it's that time at Paramount is really, you know, their heyday. As far as I'm concerned anyway, it's like, you know, Animal Crackers, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and then Duck Soup, I think, is the best one.
Mm.
And then later, just after, they moved to MGM.
Mm.
And I don't know if you've seen those films. It's like A Night at the Opera is the first one and A Day at the Races is next. Those are pretty good films too.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's been a while. I'm going to be honest. It's been a while since I've seen them. But A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races is probably their second, third best films that they've done. And I think it's because of they were allowed a bit of more creative freedom to kind of exercise what they wanted to do. As you mentioned, Paramount were going through, they were almost near bankrupt by the time Duck Soup came out, and there was a real general sense that the Marx Brothers weren't going to get paid. So they were even threatening to even create their own studio, their own little company, so they can distribute their films. So, you know, I think with MGM, it gave them the certain kind of like a new lease of life. And by when it came to, for me, I think I personally think it's A Night at the Opera is probably their second best film. But as we get into this podcast, it'll be Duck Soup, which is for me their best one.
Well, no, sometimes I think A Night at the Opera is the best one, you know, but it's got some of their funniest stuff in it, definitely.
Yeah.
I think what happens at MGM is like, the films start to have these like subplots, you know, like romantic subplots and stuff, which are a bit more kind of, they seem kind of unnecessary to me. They're a bit more mawkish, and they're there to kind of maximize their appeal, I guess. But it makes the films a little bit more conventional. But at the same time, you know, they're still fantastically good. And yeah. then they kind of tail off after a certain point, I think. And they kind of lose their magic, or, you know, they kind of pass their peak. But can't be helped, of course.
Can't help. And that's typical of pretty much most performers around that time as well. You know, I think, you know, I know it's a little bit off subject, but Lauren Hardy, you know, it was probably about past the 40s that they never really recaptured, you know, their earlier work from the sort of the late 20s to the 30s. So they've missed it. Their peak sadly came to an end as well. So I think it's just one of those things where, you know, around that time where the country's changing, everything is changing, fashion's changing,
culture's changing,
film changing, you know, and it's about adaptability. And sadly, you know, I think around the 50s, that kind of idea of comedy being slapstick is not the conventional anymore. I think people now move by that time dramatic stories, and, you know, by the sort of the late 50s, we started getting CinemaScope and all those kind of new technologies and dramas and sweeping landscapes and so forth. So it's just an unfortunate sign of the times.
Yeah, and like also we're not long out of the silent era at this time. And some of those silent comedians had a sticky kind of transition to sound as well, didn't they? People like Buster Keaton, of course. And so, yeah, you're definitely right about adaptability, I think. Slapstick, yeah, definitely goes out of vogue at some point. You get people like Jerry Lewis who, you know, we're kind of in that vein, I suppose.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Duck Soup then. So, 1933, directed by Leo McCarey, starring, of course, the Marx Brothers, Chico, Groucho, Harpo and Zeppo. Zeppo's last film with them, actually. How would you like, I don't know, if you came across somebody, you were going to sit them down and watch Duck Soup, they didn't know who the Marx Brothers were, didn't know anything about it, how would you kind of pitch it to them? How would you kind of tee it up for somebody? It's kind of hard to describe, it's so yeah. wild, isn't it?
Yeah, it's... You know, I would say, imagine the likes of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and Harold Lloyd. Imagine if they were all in a film together, but that each character that they have was so unique and distinct that they're each a comedy on its own. So I think that's probably the best way to kind of describe it. And I think that's what makes the Marx Brothers so different, is that you don't get just one brand of comedy. You get the whole package. And you know, you get the wit of Groucho, you get Chico, the kind of the Italian American kind of Pinocchio, who often says some dumb dim-witted kind of analogies. You get Harpo, who is you know, almost like a traditional mime artist, you know, he's a silent visual one. And then Zeppo is kind of almost like the jack of all trades. He's like he almost has, you know, features of like a classic, you know, not quite Bogart, but that kind of, you know, leading man kind of persona. So I would say that they are, yeah, four unique individuals who all have their own stamp on comedy, and you will laugh your head off at them.
Yeah, well, that's definitely my experience. I think we'll have a good time talking about this one. But if we don't, you know, if you don't like it, you can leave in a taxi.
Yeah.
If you don't leave in a taxi, yeah. You can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a half. Yeah. That's one of my favourite gags. Yeah. anyway, let me tell you how I watched this, because I know we talked a little bit about this, which is that I just bought the Blu-ray set that came out. It came out about a year ago, I think, in the UK. All the Paramount films, and it includes The Coconuts, which I've never seen before. I haven't had time to watch it yet, but it wasn't on the DVD set I used to have. And let me tell you, if I could describe this Blu-ray set to you in one word, Kelechi,
yeah,
that word would be orgasmic. It's just it's a big step up over the DVD.
Yeah,
like the picture quality and everything. It comes with a really nice little booklet.
Yeah,
some good essay writing.
Yeah,
really nice packaging. So yeah, I know you were saying you were holding out for like a different, you know, you want a set involving all the films, but I don't think you get that because of the rights and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, I'm so picky. It's not to say that I didn't want that box set. I really did want that box set, but I'm one of those people, like, I just don't want just trying to minimize double dip. So if I'm kind of, I know it will never happen. So I'll probably just like, probably at the end of this podcast, I'll just go like, you know, screw it. I'm just going to buy it. give it to me. But I would love them to be like a singular collection of all their films. You know, I remember, you know, again, off topic, you know, I remember getting the DVD box set of Lauren Hardy, and it was like this massive, like almost shaped like a trunk box, you know, because of all their movies. And, you know, and that had different, you know, rights and holders and so forth. So maybe, you know, in the near future, the Marx Brothers would be given that same love and get that same restoration, because they are part of movie history and they are a classic. But I'm, you know, like I said, I've got no regrets at the moment, but probably after this I'll be like, yeah, Amazon. I'm waiting for Prime Day, basically. I'm just waiting for Prime Day to kind of cash in and see if it goes down in price.
Well, I'd highly recommend it anyway. Anyway, I've sat down to watch the film this week, obviously, and, you know, I think it really is a great film. I think it is their best.
Yeah.
One of the things I really like about it is it's very brisk, isn't it? It's only on for, like, 68 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, I'm all for a good short running time, to be honest. So, like I said, it's not really, like, marred by some of the things that feature in their other films. You know, it hasn't got these kind of unnecessary subplots or interludes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think maybe part of it is that they're working with probably the best director they've ever worked with here, which is Leo McCarey. Because I think often they'd work with like decent filmmakers, but this guy is actually a cut above, I think. You know, he'd worked a lot with Laurel and Hardy. I saw a great film of his just recently with Cary Grant called The Awful Truth, you know, and other stuff people might have seen, like An Affair to Remember, Make Way for Tomorrow. And that's really what struck me again watching it this week, you know, is this is actually a very well-made film.
Mm.
You know, very handsomely mounted. Like those early scenes where they're at the reception for Firefly. you know, the scene where they sing, like, When the Clock on the Wall Strikes 10, all that kind of stuff. You know, the sets are just, like, very lavish, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's all staged, like, very effectively. So that's one of the reasons I think this film works so well.
Yeah, I think it's just a great balance of, you know, specifically with Duck Soup, it's just a great balance of that music, the, you know, going to the musical side of it and then giving the slapstick. And then giving the kind of, you know, it's the very thinnest of plots, but it's a very simple plot. And that's one of the great things about it. I think what I love about the structure of it is how we all know what the Marx Brothers are. We know they're going to bring their own brand of chaos. But the first, say, 10 or 15 minutes, it's literally almost like you're waiting in anticipation for one of them to show up, like, you know, like, oh yeah, we're waiting for Groucho to show up, but, you know, and then it's, you know, it's all this kind of pomp and glossy affairs. You know, you've got your soldiers, you know, coming out in marching, you've got the little ballerinas, and you've got the, you know, the rose petals being thrown up, which obviously brings memories of me watching Coming to America and watching Prince Akeem waiting for his new bride to be, that is arranged marriage. So you got all of that, and then, you know, you have this grand fanfare of waiting for a Marx Brothers to turn up, and he ends up being late for his own inauguration. And he just turns up in the background. It's like, oh, what's this for? It's like, you're waiting for somebody? Like, yeah. And he just gets out, Groucho in classic style, gets out his cigar nose in his mouth and just holds it up like how the soldiers hold it. Yeah, so it's I love the kind of the anticipation way, because what happens straight after that is just 100 miles per hour comedy slapstick. You almost sometimes struggle to keep up because it is just so, it's like that sentence, if you blink and you miss it, but with the Marx Brothers, if you like somehow close your ears, you miss it.
Oh no, definitely, because like the gag rate is just like a mile a minute, isn't it? And you know, not all of them are like great, some of them are real groaners, but they come so fast it doesn't really matter. So yeah, but like the way it sets up is interesting, because we've got this setting, you know, Fredonia, kind of like faux European. I think the word is like Ruritanian for this kind of setting, you know. And I just thought that's interesting, because they're normally in the real world, aren't they? But here we've got this completely like mythical, almost kingdom, it seems, you know. And we meet Margaret Dumont's character, Mrs. Teasdale. And she appears obviously with the Marxes a few times. I think she's been missing from the previous two films in the run-up to this one.
Yeah.
She'd been in Animal Crackers and then she's back again. But it's great whenever she is in it, because she's a great straight woman, I think, and she plays off Groucho really well, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. I mean, I think one of the funny things that I just recently learned about is that she never really understood the humor done by the Marx Brothers, which I think, which is, and that is both like on screen and off screen. I think she just was almost mystified by what they were doing, which I think that's what makes her performance great, because it makes her genuine. And it kind of reminds me of like the Carry On films, where, you know, the actors like, you know, Sid James and Kenneth Williams, you know, they weren't really comedians. They were classically trained, you know, theatrical kind of actors. But in certain situations, they knew they can deliver a line with as a comedy. And I think that's what Margaret Dumont kind of does. That she's like that perfect representation of that straight-laced humor. And Duck Soup, for me, is probably her best performance, because she is almost the same one, you know, and the diplomatic one, you know, and she has the, you know, just has the kind of almost grace and you know, dignity. You know, obviously she wanted best for her country, you know, that the whole idea of like, you know, I will give you money, give you that extra 20 million, but only if you hire Rufus T. Firefly. We need a progressive new leader. And then it's almost like, oh crap, I've made a mistake. Okay, I'm just trying to be the diplomatic person in this medal. And I think that's one thing that I think no one quite gives her credit for. You know, I think it's her performance is almost on the you know, underrated. You know, I know we see a lot of the Marx Brothers, and you know, they obviously, you see what you see, you get from them. But with Margaret Dumont, her, you know, underrated performance is that, you know, what she, you know, amongst all that sharpness and the sheer pace of it, she's the one that's reasonable. She's the one that's trying to find peace. She's trying to prevent war at every single obstacle. But you know, it's all to no avail. You know. And, you know, and there's just something, you know, funny, you know, as we kind of also live in this kind of generation of like Me Too and Time's Up, you know, sometimes as a character, she's not kind of valued for her character. So she only just becomes almost like an object of affection between Firefly and Trentino. And she's only used for like, oh, if I marry her, she has money and therefore I can do whatever I want.
Yeah. And the film ends with like she's being like pelted with stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I've heard those stories as well about how she wasn't really in on the joke and stuff. And some people disagree. Some people think that's kind of selling her a bit short and she knew what she was doing. I don't know. But I think definitely what you say, she's definitely undervalued.
Yeah. I mean, there's a line that I think, you know, obviously when you're a kid, when I watched this first time when I was about 6 or 7 years old, you know, obviously the jokes and the humour just kind of goes over your head. And I was more attracted to the visual humour. But over the years, you know, you start to kind of notice quite a few things. So the way like Firefly was talking about her is like, this is probably going to be the worst Groucho impression, but he's like, married. I can see you right now in the kitchen bending over a hot stove, but I can't see the stove. You know?
Wow, it's like he was in the room.
It's like, at one part, it's like, maybe back in the day, I'd have laughed my head off. And in some ways, I still do, but it's just like, that's not. That's really bad, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's also stuff like, I can offer you a Rufus over your head, you know, and stuff like that. And it hits us something, because you know what, this film, you know, it's brought out just before the production code starts to be enforced, which means that this is a bit more risque than they would have been able to get away with, like, even just a year or two later, you know. Even down to stuff like, you know that character Raquel Torres, played by Vera Marcel, she's got these, like, quite revealing gowns.
Mm.
Like, if the film had been made in the code era, they might not have been able to costume her like that, you know. So it comes at quite an interesting point in that sense.
I feel like they were always trying to almost take the Mickey out of the Hays Code as well, because there's a great scene with Harpo, and he's on a horse in the third act, you know, warning the townspeople like, oh, war's coming, you know, blowing his trumpet. And he catches the attention of this young woman, and he rides his horse up the stairs, and it has this great shot of the, like, it's a woman's shoes, it's Harpo's shoes, and then it's horseshoes. And then obviously you're thinking, okay, they had sex, they got it on. But then the very next scene is like she's on another bed and Harpo is sleeping next to a horse. So it was like, it was almost like they were trying to sort of test that Hays Code. It's like, yeah, I bet you can't, you know, say anything about that.
Let's talk a bit more about Groucho. I mean, what a rogue. Because, like, he was always my, like, very favourite as a child. And I don't know why, but probably for several reasons. I mean, I like his look. You know, the grease paint moustache, the fake eyebrows and everything. And, like, his very distinctive, like, way of walking, you know. Just also the way you would sort of break with convention, you know, breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
I mean, they all kind of break with convention, really. I mean, Harpo and Chico do anyway.
Yeah. But
just very naturally funny, I find, Groucho. Is he your favourite?
Yeah, he is. Sorry, I'm laughing because I'm just always remembering something, like, either he said or, like, I'm just remembering the scene where he comes and meets Mrs. Teasdale after, like, Trentino tries to kind of make his move on her, and he turns up at the party and he's just walking past like a table, he grabs a donut and he walks past another table and he dunks the donut in some coffee. Just the kind of like, I know, I mean business. I mean, I absolutely love Groucho. I think when I was a kid, I think I was probably more attracted to the Chico and Harpo just because of their visual sense of jokes. And I think obviously because I grew up around sort of Laurel and Hardy, that kind of almost remind me of that in a sort of antithesis kind of way. But Groucho over the years has become my favorite. I think he's like the complete package of comedy, you know, as you were talking about his dress sense, you know, is, you know, it's iconic in the same way that Chaplin perfected the kind of the Trump kind of look in his films, you know. And it's just it's like the complete package. It's just the wit and the mix of the physical comedy. I think one of my favorite bits is how he tries to get transportation in Fredonia. It's like his Excellency car, and he's like, you know, like, ride like the wind and get me there as, you know, as fast as you can. And then he's sitting in the sidecar and the bike just goes off, and it's almost like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And it happens like, I think it's like three times.
Yeah.
of that joke, and he just seems to have the right word for it, and I think it's just so distinct. Like, I can even if I say a Groucho Marx line, it will never be the same, you know, because he has perfected that delivery. He knows exactly how to say that line and say it with the right amount of almost tease, and I don't know, professional is not really the right word, but he just knows how to get the right amount of that joke and just leave you howling with laughter, you know. I mean, I mean, I'm sure we've got some other examples. I'm just like,
yeah, one that springs to mind for me. I don't even know if it's that funny, really. It always makes me laugh though, where he's like, you know, pick a card, take it. I got 51 more. I don't know.
No, I'm just remembering it, like, this sort of the entire third act, which is kind of Groucho and his elements. You know, like, you know, every scene they cut to his little station or bunker. He's like, and it's like he's switching different like historical costumes. Like, one minute you see him as a Boy Scout, next minute you see him as like, you're seeing like a Civil War general, next minute he's like, he's got the British foot soldier,
yeah,
kind of, you know. And then there's like, you know, there's even a bit where I was cracking up, where he grabs a machine gun and he starts, you know, shooting his own men, and Zeppo's like, well, Your Excellency, you're shooting your own men. And he's like, you know, again, it's like, here's $5, keep it under your hat.
Yeah, well, I like that song he sings, which is like, just wait till I get through with it, you know.
Yeah,
he's coming in as the leader and he's telling them exactly what he's going to do and everything. And what about this spying subplot then, though? Because that's what kind of Harpo and Chico are involved in. And I quite like it, to be honest. It never feels too kind of cumbersome to me or anything. You know, we've got the ambassador, Trentino, played by Louis Calhern, and Raquel Torres, like we already mentioned, you know. And I think he's especially good, Calhern. You know, he's a good foil for them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like what you were saying. I mean, when I was, when my son was about five, I sat him down to watch the Marx Brothers films. And his favourite, the one he was drawn to immediately, was Harpo, you know. And it's just the kind of, I think it must have been like, you know, the freedom, or not the freedom, like, Harpo does exactly what he wants, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, cutting people's pockets out or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And I just remember my son would like laugh like a drain at his like antics, you know. But I mean, I really like Harpo too. I think, would he be my second favourite? I don't know.
I think probably as a kid, yeah, so Harpo, I don't know, it's hard to rank them.
Zeppo would be last.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we all agree on that one. But yeah, Harpo... Yeah, I probably would say he's the second best, just because he's just unique. You know, I just remember, like, obviously he makes up for the lack of a voice with his body movement. And, you know, I love that scene where he's with Firefly and he's, you know, you know, hey, what's your name? And then he's like, he's pulling up his arm and he's like showing a tattoo of his, like, where do you live? And he's like pulling off his, like, he's lifting off his shirt and he just shows like a doghouse.
Yeah, and a dog here.
And I think Garcher just takes it to the next level. It's like, you would never like a picture of my father, would you? And then he's like, he's about to pull down his pants. Like, oh, no, 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 don't, you know, show me next time.
Yeah.
So I love his sense of timing with, I think, with Harpo. I think his act is, I would say, unique, and it's different from everyone else, and it stands out. It's not quite the wittiness of what Groucho does, but it's definitely the physicality of what he's performing. And it's almost reminiscent of Stan Laurel, you know, in terms of, you know, his characteristics. You know, I even remember the joke or the scene in where just prior to the mirror joke, where Chico and Harpo are about to enter the house and they ring the doorbell, and they're just like, it's just, he goes in the house, he closed the door, and Chico's left on the outside, and then he's run back to escape the guard, and then he finally finds a break, rings the doorbell, Harpo comes back out to get him back in the house, and then Chico runs in and slaps the door. So I think for me with Harpo, I think he works well with Chico as a double act. So I think it's almost like trying to rank, you know, who's the best. I think Harpo does edge it because of what he brings to it, and it, especially because he's also can't make a sound, and then there's a whole sequence where he's making sound like he's
so. Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right that like they're a great double act. I really do like Chico, actually. I don't want to like see him be overshadowed, yeah. But I really enjoy his like wordplay, and I think that comes out a lot when he pairs up with Groucho, yeah. Chico. So I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene with the lemonade salesman is interesting because he doesn't really do that much to provoke them, really. They just kind of they go after him, don't they?
It's just like an innocent bystander. I kind of look at that joke in some sort of similar way as a kind of visual representation of like how stupid war can be. So you've got Groucho and Lewis Calhoun as Trantino acting, you know, almost a verbal kind of like, you know, hey, you upstart, you swine, that sort of thing. And then, you know, you've got Ciccolini and Pinky just, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, we get into a fight, and then you're dragging somebody else along into the chaos. And the thing is, it's like, it's just the way it escalates. I think that's the kind of the beauty of the joke, you know, because, you know, I think maybe, you know, from a recent watch, you know, it kind of feels like it's kind of separate. It doesn't kind of almost make sense, but somehow they've made it, they justify its inclusion. So it's like the way it starts out is just Ciccolini and Pinky just fighting with each other. They drag the lemonade vendor. Next minute it's like, you know, I'm just trying to get the truth out of him. And, you know, and then next minute it's like escalation. It's the comical timing of swapping their hats together and it's burning their hats. And then, you know, next minute it's like destroying each other's business. Like, you know, who can go one up and do the worst of it? And then, you know, in the third act, you know, unsuspectingly, because you felt like the film has changed by then, somehow they reintroduced the lemonade vendor back when Pinky finds his wife and, you know, is trying to like almost have his way with him. And he's like, the wife's like, oh, my husband's back, and you didn't realize it's him. And it's like, what kind of like fortunate coincidence can this be? And I love how they keep sort of justifying that joke, even though it's probably a slight weakness of the film, because besides the spying stuff and despite one scene where Ciccolini is selling peanuts and it attracts the attention of Rufus T. Firefly, like nothing else, that's just all them. Like everything else is just all them. Like that's them, that in their kind of almost side story. And it doesn't add to anything to the major plot, except for the fact that this is them in their element showing their slapstick behavior.
And I'll tell you what, like this film is missing in a certain sense is like a couple of their trademarks, really, because most of their other films have, you know, a scene where Harpo sits down to play the harp, or you get a scene of Chico on the piano.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't have that, but in a way I like that, because like I say, you've got this really like brisk running time for Duck Soup, and I'm not sure another 10 minutes of those kind of scenes would have benefited the film or not, to be honest, even though I do like it whenever we see like those scenes in the other films.
Yeah, I think to be fair, Harpo does, well, he doesn't play the harp, but he does play the piano, the strings, and he plays it almost like a harp. So I think that's kind of them, I would say, trying to sort of buck the trend and trying to give the audience something a little bit different. So it's like not like a kind of caricature cliche in every kind of film. But yeah, I think they just show how great they work together as an ensemble. It's just the perfection of comedy. You know, I think it's the essence of a great political satire, you know, and somehow the slapstick and the accuracy of their jokes seems to just lend into that larger theme of, you know, of what satire is, which somehow has a strange kind of eerie Indiana kind of reference. You know, it just seems like this is exactly what's happening in the world today, and it's just the stupidity of politics, and they've managed to kind of tap into that, even though I feel like that wasn't what they wanted to originally do, because I think just based on a little bit of research that it started off as a medieval film, and then it just quietly just became that kind of constant reiteration, and it suddenly sort of turned into sort of this kind of political satire, and it's crazy how they've done that, and it still holds up today after all these years.
And it's interesting that, like, supposedly whenever Groucho was asked about, you know, Duck Soup as a satire, he was always like, you know, we were just trying to make it funny, you know. But like in Italy, Mussolini did ban the film, you know. So
yeah, because he thought the film was about him. So and then when the Marx Brothers found out, they were like, oh, pretty fantastic, happy. Really, yeah, they were fantastic. It was great. I mean, there's even just slight jokes about, you know, even Fredonia, because obviously it's fictional. But there is a town in New York called Fredonia. And apparently at the time, they, you know, were disheartened that their town was being mocked and in this way. And when the Marx Brothers found out, they replied back to, I think, like the mayor of Fredonia or something like that, and said, can you change the name of your town? You're ruining our picture. Yeah. You know, like that. And that kind of just shows you like the great timing of their humor, you know. And that's not just in present of the film, it's also outside of that picture. And I feel like they were just onto something. That I think, like, Duck Soup is just ahead of its time.
Let's circle back to the stuff about the war and the satire and everything, because I want to talk about that mirror scene, you know. So we get this stuff, like, there's the break-in to steal the plans, isn't there, and everything. And we get a famous scene in front of the mirror.
Mm.
And, you know, this gag, obviously it's associated with Duck Soup primarily, but it's actually an older gag, you know, and it'd been variations on it had been in older pictures. And what I've read is that it was Leo McCary's suggestion to include it in Duck Soup. So that's kind of a masterstroke, really. And to be honest, it doesn't really matter even if it had been done before, because, like, this is the definitive example of that joke, isn't it? And you were saying it's your favourite scene in the film.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, it's like, it's the sheer absurdity of the whole entire scene. It's like something so simple. Go into the house, steal some plans, get out before you get caught or you be tried for treason. And somehow they just seem to make a mess of it at every stage of the way. And it's not just a joke, and it's the mirror joke in itself. It's the also the build up towards it. It's, you know, as I mentioned before, it's Ciccolini and Pinky trying to get into the house, and then, you know, when that all fails, you know, it's Martel coming back to, you know, letting them in through the back door, and then he's like, oh, don't make a sound, and the next minute they keep making a sound, and then they find out where the combination is, and
blasting out.
Yeah,
you know.
But even just prior to that, it's like they go up to Firefly's room, locking him in his bathroom, Ciccolini dressing up as Rufus T. Firefly,
yeah.
going to Mrs. Teasdale, trying to get the combination, and it's like, oh yeah, the combination is downstairs, or the safe's downstairs, sorry. And then it's just the sheer hilarity is, like, obviously Rufus is in another room locked up, but the fact that Ciccolini and Pinky almost do fantastic interpretation of Groucho Marx, you know. And it's like they get the grease paint on his mustache, they somehow, I don't know how many glasses Groucho has, but and how many exact same pajama clothings that he has, but they get that all down, get the little headscarf on, and then get a, like a cigar and just literally impersonate him. And, you know, and you know, I love like Mrs. Teasdale was like talking to Chico. It's like, you're like, your voice sounds strange. And it's like, oh, I'm trying out a new accent, you know. And then it's, you know, and then it's like almost like swapping places and you're trying to almost distinguish who's the real Rufus T. Firefly. And then it just culminates in that mirror scene. And as you were saying before, like it's not a new joke. It has been performed before by Harold Lloyd in one of his films. And obviously there's references to like Lauren Hardy, but obviously this is the definitive one. But it kind of goes to show how that joke still lives on in the memory when it appears in the X-Files in the episode called Dreamland. I think it was used in an episode of Family Guy. And it is the absurdity of looking, you know, the mirror's broken and then somebody copying your act. And, you know, and it's obviously Rufus trying to catch out his double. Like he knows the situation is wrong and he knows it's wrong. But it's kind of like, how does Harpo one up him to prove that this is real, to prove that this, that the joke is still real. And I think one of my favorite bits is when like Rufus is just like, he's looking down, he's looking around, putting he's crossing his arms, he does like a little dance, and then next minute he spins around and Harpo just stands still and he's yeah. He just stands still like pretending he's done it. and obviously the hats, like they reinforce the hat jokes again, so obviously the surrealness is like they swap positions and you see the hats in the and you know they're different, but somehow before when they return back to their original position, the hats are still the same, so, or the hats are more or less close the same. And you know, by that time the gag is up, but it's the absurdity of that moment. And I can understand that. I think that joke took like 2 hours to rehearse just to get every bit of it in sync, and it just pays off. And as I said before, it lays down a legacy that it's been used in the X-Files, it's been used in Family Guy, it's the definitive joke.
Yeah, no, it's definitely had a long like shelf life, hasn't it? And because there's even on the sitcom I Love Lucy,
yes,
you know, that comes along and Harpo Marx appears with Lucy to do like a rendition of the gag as well. So I mean, yeah, definitely the most iconic scene in the film. But I don't know, maybe slightly controversial. I do like it, but it's not my favourite. I think for me, it's because I'm more into the wordplay, you know. I love a corny pun and stuff like that. So
yeah.
My favourite scene might be that courtroom scene, you know, where Chico's on trial or whatever. I'm not quite sure if it's, yeah. You know, the legal accuracy of the scene is probably questionable, but hey. But that's got some of my favourite gags, like the stuff about, you know, what lives in the circus weighs 500 pounds or whatever. That's irrelevant. That's right. Irrelevant. You know, just
irrelevant.
I love that stuff. I love it.
I mean, I think what's great about that scene is like, as you were talking about, you know, Chico bouncing off Groucho, and I love that Groucho comes off and he's like, look at Chicolina. You may talk like an idiot. You may sound like an idiot. You may look like an idiot. But he really is an idiot. You know, like it's like that reinforcing his like his dim-wittedness, but at the same time like adding to the hilarity of the whole thing. I mean, the fact that scene ends with like almost a song and dance.
Yeah, well, that song and dance is interesting because I mean, I guess Tuxedo is a musical, but it's not really the first thing I think of when I think of the film. But actually, I really do like, you know, all the songs we get. There's just something about like the joy of like the Marx Brothers generally, but it seems to be kind of encapsulated in that musical sequence, you know, where it starts off with Fredonia going to war. It segues into like All God's Children Got Guns.
I do love that sequence, but I think my favorite song, I mean, you've touched upon it, is it literally is Groucho and singing his Laws of Administration, you know, and because it's done in such a whimsical way. You know, but he's literally promoting torture and terror within the dictatorship. And I think that one kind of resonates so much, much for me, because he contradicts the whole thing by saying that this is the land of the free. So even though he's like, he's banning dirty jokes, he's chewing gum is forbidden. And the idea of executing people by Pop Goes the Weasel, you know, it's things like that, you know, I think kind of reinforces the message of the film. And you know, yeah, and I guess that you can look at the fact that the, you know, we're going to war dance in that third act as, you know, almost like the crescendo, you know, like that final big piece, you know, and it is a joyous occasion, I think. But I think it's a great balance between the seriousness, the political essence of it, and also just them having a great time.
So let's talk a bit more about it as like satire. So obviously in the real world, as people will know, you know, across Europe, certain dictatorships kind of taking hold at this point in the early to mid 1930s. So you can definitely read like an anti-war message into the film, I think, you know, about the craziness of war, the insanity of it. You know, we've got this war between Fredonia and Sylvania, and it's kind of signaled with, you know, some dialogue, you know, stuff like they're talking about trying to stop the war, but then I think Groucho says, I've already paid a month's rent on the battlefield, you know, stuff like that. But also the fact that in like the terms of the film, like visually, like the narrative, that the logic seems to break down, doesn't it? Like, narrative logic, causal logic, like what, you get these rapid fire ridiculous costume changes at this point in the film, don't you? You get this like ludicrous stock footage of like elephants and God knows what else. So like I think there is a point there about like the, like I said, the insanity, the craziness of war that kind of comes through, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this for me is almost like the original political satire. I'm sure there has been others that have been around, you know, I think of, you know, The Great Dictator, but that was years later. But I feel like this is the original one. And I think like, you know, the comedic styles that Duck Soup perpetuates is, you know, I think a lot of films today owe a lot of credit to that. So I think whether you've seen films like Dr. Strangelove or The Death of Stalin, or even, you know, TV shows like The Thick of It, you know, or even that film In the Loop.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of that wit and slapstick humor that can be traced back to Duck Soup. And, you know, I think one of my favorite bits out of that third act is where they say like, oh yeah, we're gonna canvas for men and get people and Harpo's on the battlefield with a billboard saying, you know, come join the army. And he's like in the middle of a battlefield. So I think it says a lot about, you know, the essence of like how stupid most of these wars start out. I think it says a lot about, you know, the idea of the dictatorships. You know, obviously we mentioned about Mussolini and the rise of Hitler, you know, and how a lot of things start off as almost like insults or, you know, personal grievances, but they're never done in the good of the people. And because of two personal grievances between two characters, Fredonia and Sylvania are fighting each other. But, but there's so many ludicrous moments. It's almost like you can't keep up with the third act because you've got like a literal representation of a bomb flying through the room. You got Harpo trapped in a closet full of fireworks, and you don't know why there are fireworks there, but the fact that he was smoking and then he like just chucks it and the whole place just starts to blow up. You got even probably one of my favorite Chico jokes in that film is he's come back from being the double agent. He's like, yeah, I'll join you again. And Groucho's like, yeah, sending him out into the war zone. Chico's like, oh, I'm not going out in there unless I'm in one of those metal things that go up and down. What do you call that? And Groucho goes, tanks. You're welcome. Yeah. So I think it just got it. By then, it's almost like this kind of creative freedom to kind of express, like, you know, I know it's, it, you know, they're not fortune tellers or anything like that, but I think it just kind of just shows like how quickly things can escalate in such a short space of time. And, you know, I think, you know, because of the what was happening around in the 30s, I don't want to preempt it, but it almost feels like that was one of those kind of reasons to kind of almost say that as a political message, even though I don't think they were saying that as a political message. But I think that's what, you know, quietly amongst themselves, it's like, this is kind of like how stupid war can be and how stupid government, well, dictatorships can act in such a way. And it kind of goes to show, as we living in this kind of current world right now with, you know, with the Trump presidency, you know, it kind of just shows that we haven't quite learned our lesson. You know, it's still as relevant as it is, as it was back then.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like prescient, I guess is the word. But what's interesting, I was listening to the commentary track on the Blu-ray, and one of the guys on there was saying, you know, when the film came out in the 30s, because there's this kind of tradition of just like nonsense comedy films, audiences at the time sort of saw it more in that light, didn't really focus on the satire element. And then when the film gets a bit of a revival in the 60s, you know, that's the point at which people started to see these things a bit more clearly. But yeah, great stuff, great stuff. I guess we should do some final thoughts then. I mean, have you got any more kind of points you were kind of desperate to bring up on this one, Kletchy?
Listen, I want everybody to go and watch this if you can. If you can get a copy of it, get it on Blu-ray, get it on DVD, whatever, however you want to watch it, have a watch of this. I think, you know, whenever there's like, you know, like a top 100 best films done by magazines and so forth, you know, obviously I know these lists are highly subjective, so it doesn't really bother me so much. But I'm always curious and interested how they do the sort of differentiation gap between the sort of modern films of like the last 30, 40 years and then the films from the old Hollywood. And sometimes I feel like Duck Soup probably doesn't get the same level of exposure as most comedies does. And I truly believe it is one of the best comedies that are out there. I think it deserves to be seen in the best quality it can be. I think it's still as relevant today as it was back then. As I mentioned before, I think it's political satire at its best. I think you can see a lot of that humor coming derived from, like, say, Dr. Strangelove and Death of Stalin. And, you know, for me, as a personal experience, it was the first, you know, black and white film that I've ever saw, which was, which comically asked the stupid question to my brothers, you know, like, whether the whole world was in black and white. you know, see it because I personally recommend it. See it because it is one of the great comics. It was my first personal exposure to the Marx Brothers, and that will serve as a brilliant building block to your cinematic journey.
Yeah, no, I think people should see it, definitely. I think it should be mandatory. You know, if I was a Rufus D. Firefly-esque leader, that would be one of my first decrees, you know.
I that'd probably be the only policy I'll follow you on. Everything else will, you know, I'll debate it to myself.
Yeah, no, we should definitely get together again to talk the Marxes at some point. I think A Night at the Opera would be good because we could sort of compare the style at a different studio. That might be a good one to do. So
absolutely.
We'll talk. All right, so I guess we will wrap up there. So on the social media, where can we find you?
So you can find my blog at confessionsfromageekmind.com. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, it's at geekminduk.
Cool. All right. Well, cheers, Kletchy.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, you can find me on Twitter at moviepalacepod. You can find, that's the podcast, moviepalacepod. You can find me at csweeney758. You can search for the podcast on Facebook. I've got a page there. Just type in Movie Palace. It should come up, hopefully. Next time, then. So, provisional plan. I think next episode, I'll be joined by Paige Schechter from the Sibling Cinema blog, and I believe we'll be talking about the Philadelphia Story. Maybe just keep an eye on social media and watch this space if there's any change to the lineup, which is possible. I'll let everybody know. Keep you posted. But in any case, I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.